This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Stories from the American Revolution often include images of Paul Revere on horseback, George Washington crossing the Delaware, or the Redcoats firing on the colonists at the Boston Massacre. But other people and places also played an important role in the war. Along the Gulf Coast, places like Pensacola and Baton Rouge, in those places, the Spanish and Native Americans tried to exploit the rebellion to advance their own interests. Historian Kathleen Duvall examines the complex wartime relationships between Indians, slaves, the Spanish, and the French, and argues that what Americans consider their fight for independence was in fact a world war. Kathleen Duvall is a professor of American history at UNC Chapel Hill. Her new book is called Independence Lost, Lives at the Edge of the American Revolution. She's going to read at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on July 30th, but first joins me in the studio. Kathleen, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's a great pleasure.
Tell us about these. You look at the Gulf Coast and some of the battles that took place there. Tell us what was going on along the Gulf Coast.
So it's a part of the American Revolution that most Americans don't know anything about. In fact, most historians don't know anything about. The Gulf Coast was split between the Seven Years' War and the American Revolution, the French and Indian War and the American Revolution, between Spain and Britain. France had lost the French and Indian War and cleared out. And so when this rebellion broke out on the Atlantic coast, first in Boston and spread from there, the Spanish, who had fought against the British in the past, as well as the French, who were on the same side as the Spanish, decided to take advantage of this war and to attack Britain while the empire was fighting against its own colonists. And so what happened on the Gulf Coast were several battles between the Spanish and the British, which is why I think we don't learn that much about them, because they were between the Spanish were involved rather than the rebels themselves. And the Spanish won battles at Mobile and Pensacola and Baton Rouge.
With the help of Native Americans, I mean, the fact that the other part of the equation is how Native Americans are taking to all of this.
That's right. Native Americans were extremely important in this part of the war. Britain assumed that most southeastern Indian nations would fight on their side. Many of them had fought on the side of the British in the past.
Stop you there. Tell me about that assumption. Why did they assume? I mean, one way or the other, some Europeans are going to be, you know, messing with our territory. Why did the British think that the Indians would be fighting with them?
So at the end of the French and Indian War, at the end of the Seven Years' War, the Native Americans who had fought, many of whom had fought on the side of the British, but even more of whom had fought on the side of the French, argued to the British and, in the case of Pontiac's War, continue fighting against the British to try to persuade the British not to move on to their lands. And so in the Proclamation of 1763, which was a proclamation from the British Crown, they said, the British Crown said, American settlers, which were British settlers at the time, of course, for the most part weren't allowed to go west of the Appalachians unless they had particular permission from the Crown and from the Indian tribe whose land it was. And this is actually one of the reasons for the American Revolution. British settlers in the Atlantic colonies were very angry about this proclamation. They felt that their Crown had chosen Indians over them. And that's why Britain assumed when this war broke out between the empire and its settlers that, of course, Indians would choose the empire against the settlers because, and they were right about this, the settlers were the real problem that Indians faced.
Then they could be a check against westward expansion. Didn't work out that way. They, especially when it came to the Creek, they were much more deliberate and nuanced in their understanding of the role they should and should not play.
That's exactly right. And it was a big debate in Creek country. Many Creeks argued, well, let's just let the empire and its settlers fight this out. And we'll just sort of pick up the pieces when they're done. They also were, when the Creeks did fight, they preferred to attack settlers who had actually come onto their lands and to drive them back to the east, whereas the British were much more, they were really wanted the Creeks to pay attention to who was a loyalist, who was rebelling, and the Creeks weren't all that interested in those those particulars.
So tell us about these battles along the Gulf Coast.
So the Spain declared war in 1779 and sent troops and ships to Spanish General Bernardo de Galvez, who was based in New Orleans. So New Orleans was part of the Spanish Empire. at the time. And he led troops to battles at Baton Rouge first, and then Mobile, and then Pensacola, which was the capital of the British colony of West Florida.
And when so, and how much attention could the British pay to all of this?
Well, this was a big change for the British in the war. What began as a rebellion, not even an independence movement, grew into a war in Massachusetts and beyond. And then this, the declaration of war by Spain, opened up a whole new front in the American Revolution on the Gulf Coast, which is what my book is about, but also in Gibraltar. And there was even an attempt by the Spanish and the French to attack Britain itself. So suddenly what had been a rebellion was, as you said in your introduction, a world war.
And it's interesting because that's really how most of Europe saw this in Britain. The idea that these Americans were going to succeed, and if they did, last very long, never occurred to anybody.
That's exactly right. And that's what really mattered were, for one thing, the more valuable colonies that suddenly were up for grabs, such as Jamaica or Cuba. These were that's where the money was to be
right.
made in empires, and also perhaps in India, Europeans were hoping. The 13 Atlantic colonies were, with the exception of South Carolina, probably the rest of them were not particularly profitable. They weren't that important to the empire, and they weren't important to other empires either. The real story became the rest of the world.
So you tell us these stories through the eyes of a number of six individuals, and one of them is a native called Piamataha. Tell us about him.
Piamataha grew up in Chickasaw country. He's a Chickasaw Indian, so lived in basically what's now Western Tennessee. He became a great warrior when he was a young man and led many Chickasaw war parties against the French. He was fighting against the French in when the French were there as part of French Louisiana. And he grew to become a major Chickasaw leader.
What role did he play and how did he become involved in this struggle?
So he was sort of elevated to the office of sort of main diplomat. And I think everybody, Chickasaws, expected him to continue the kind of militaristic past that he'd had. But when he came to power, he actually looked back on Chickasaw history of the previous two decades. They had been slave raiders. They had been involved in many wars against other American Indians as well as against the French. They had they suffered from disease, smallpox and other diseases, and he changed Chickasaw history. They became actually peacemakers.
So how did these negotiations take? Maybe I could ask you to read for us. I think I mistakenly said six people. You've got eight stories that run through here. But maybe you can read a little bit to give us a better sense of what the Piamataha was all about here.
Okay, great. This starts at the end of the French and Indian War, so about a decade before the Revolution. And the French are just leaving the region because they've lost the war. So as I said, they had been an enemy of the Chickasaw. In the summer of 1763, rumors arrived in Chickasaw country that the French had surrendered, ending the 7 years' war. The British would take over the French posts east of the Mississippi River, while the Spanish would occupy those west of the Mississippi, plus New Orleans at the river's mouth. Piamataha would need to decide how to deal with the new Spanish officials who would come to the Mississippi Valley. By this time, Piamataha had risen to the position of Chickasaw headman in charge of war and diplomacy, a role that the Chickasaws described as they put it, head leading warrior of the nation to treat with all nations. Slave raiding and warfare had become so dominant among the Chickasaws by the early 18th century that even the civil or peace chiefs at times got caught up in the violence. Yet Piamataha, despite being in the office called head leading warrior, decided to end Chickasaw wars. He figured that if the Chickasaws wanted to avoid further devastating war and population loss, the time to change had come. With the French Empire gone from North America, perhaps the Chickasaws could turn war paths back into trading paths and make peace with all Europeans and all Indians.
Kathleen Duvall reading from her latest book, Independence Lost. She's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop July 30th at 7 o'clock, but she's here with me on the state of things. And I think this is also shines. I mean, here's an individual with a vision about his people's future in the face of this new European invasion. But the complexity of the negotiations and the landscape that they, I mean, whose side are we going to be on here? And they're all Europeans and they're all carving up our land. And so because he is his position was unique among, there was a robust debate among Indian peoples at this time about how to handle this.
That's right. And so for the first couple of years in the war isn't very close to Chickasaws. And so Piamataha repeatedly goes to British officials and says, yep, we are on your side. We'll do whatever you need us to. They said they were watching the Mississippi for any invasion, which was pretty easy to do because there wasn't any. But then when these battles come to the Gulf Coast and the Spanish actually begins to fight, Britain calls on the Chickasaws. And over, British officials claim to their superiors back in Britain, don't worry about the Chickasaws. They will fight for us. They'll bring hundreds of warriors for us. And not only did the Chickasaws not particularly want to fight, Piamataha wanted them to keep peace with everyone. They really didn't want to fight the Spanish. We were talking earlier about how settlers, these British settlers, were the main problem. Fighting the Spanish was exactly counterintuitive. It was better to be allied with both the British Empire and the Spanish Empire than to turn away either of them.
So the British got it very wrong. Not only would the Indians, Native Americans, not support them, and in this case, they wouldn't fight for them, they also fought against them. And I think that brings us to Alexander McGilvary, who is a Native American by birth, but also Scottish.
Right. So Alexander McGilvary, he has a wonderful Scottish name, of course, but because the Creeks are matrilineal and his mother was Creek, the Creeks considered him fully Creek. He was completely a member of the Creek Nation. He was much younger during the Revolution than Piamataha. He, as a young man, grew up in Creek country and then went with his father, his Scottish father, and lived in Georgia for a while, and then fled back to Creek country when the Revolution broke out because his father was a loyalist.
And tell us about his involvement and how he plays a part in these battles along the Gulf.
So he comes home to Creek country. He's not a war leader. He's not a diplomat. But he did come with a commission from the British to try to get Creeks to fight for the British. So he starts going to council meetings and try to persuade people to fight. He finds out very quickly that he has no power in Creek country. He's just this young man. But he gets better at it. And he eventually does bring some Creek warriors to fight on the side of the British at the battles of Mobile and Pensacola. But most Creeks either stay home or, in the case of some Creeks, they end up going to the Spanish and working on the side of the Spanish during these battles. Both sides try very hard not to end up actually fighting each other, and they're pretty good at staying out of the battle so that Creeks aren't fighting Creeks during the war.
Tell us about this, particularly the Battle of Pensacola, how it was fought and then the outcome, because that's very important to the outcome of the Revolutionary War.
That's right. The Battle of Pensacola was a siege, so Spanish troops and both Spanish and French ships came and besieged Pensacola by both land and water. And the British were holed up inside Pensacola, hoping for reinforcements from sea at first, but then the French and Spanish ships blockaded Pensacola. So the only chance for British reinforcement was Indians coming by land. They knew there was no chance of British troops coming by land all the way from the East Coast. But they really believed that the Creeks would come, and the Creeks are Creeks and Choctaws both are even larger nations than the Chickasaws. So if they had come and the Chickasaws had come, it really would have made a huge difference in the battle. But by this point, not only do we have all the reasons we were already talking about American Indians not particularly wanting to fight for the British had been very sort of ham-handed in trying to order Indians around. So really only a few hundred American Indians came and fought on the side of the British. They actually still did most of the fighting because there were so few British troops there. But they didn't come in the large numbers that might have allowed the British to win the Battle of Pensacola.
They lost, and therein lies a tale, because that allowed the Spanish fleet to move to Jamaica. And tell us that story.
Yeah, so as soon as Bernardo de Galvez and the Spanish won this battle at Pensacola, he sailed with his fleet to the West Indies and relieved Admiral de Grasse, the French admiral, who sailed with his fleet to Yorktown and blockaded the port of Yorktown and allowed the American and French victory at Yorktown, kept the British from resupplying and sending new troops to Yorktown.
I mean, the one story we tell ourselves over and over, the victory at Yorktown, owes a lot of its outcome to the story we never tell ourselves, the Battle of Pensacola.
That's right. And the victory at Yorktown, or from the perspective of the British, the defeat at Yorktown helped them decide decide to end the war, not only for the reasons we already know that that they lost this important battle, but also because Galvez's fleet and de Grasse's fleet were then poised to get more victories in the West Indies, including probably Jamaica, the most valuable colony. And so Britain decided, they decided to cut their losses in the American Revolution before it got any worse.
You also tell the story of an enslaved American, Petit John, whose story really shines a light on what slavery was like back in the 18th century. Tell us about that.
Right. So Petit Jean was the was an African or descendant of Africans who lived in Mobile and was enslaved by a French-speaking master. And he lived a life that I think is quite counterintuitive to what we think of. You know, if we picture the slavery of antebellum America, what we see in 12 Years a Slave, which takes place very close to where this book takes place earlier, he was actually not a plantation slave, didn't work in a agricultural gang. He was a cattle keeper, so a cattle driver. So he tended cattle outside Mobile, spent most of his days sort of in charge of his own time, brought cattle in to be slaughtered for food when his master wanted him to. And when the Spanish invaded and took Mobile, we don't know, the documents don't tell us quite exactly how this happened, but either Petit Jean volunteered or they recruited him in some way to work for the Spanish. So he left his French master and began to be a courier, to take messages back and forth between Spanish officials, between the fleets and the troops on the ground and officials in New Orleans, and also to spy on the British and on the Chickasaws on behalf of the Spanish.
It's an incredible story. And he was also promised his freedom and got it.
That's right. So the Spanish freed several, a fairly small number, but several slaves at the end of these battles for their service. And one of them was Petit Jean.
What do we learn about this? This, so much of the story that we didn't know. Does it change anything about how we understand what we now call the American Revolution?
Well, I think the most important point I'd like people to take away from the book is reflected in the title, The Independence Lost for So Many People. We celebrate on July 4th. We assume that independence means one thing and that it's a good thing. And there were so many people in the aftermath of the American Revolution who saw various kinds of independence decline. Of course, the most obvious are American Indians who lost so much of their land and much of their sovereignty. And not only did they lose these things in the aftermath of the Revolution and the huge influx of American settlers onto their land, but I want people to know that it was a surprise to them. Not only was it not inevitable that that the United States last and expand, but it was not something that anybody but a few Americans thought would happen.
But the interesting thing too is that the diplomacy and the history of the diplomacy in the region does show that American aspirations for territory were palpable, and certainly for that one third of Americans who decided that independence was the answer. A very important part of why to go to war. We talk about the principles of freedom and liberty. The land grab, all right, greed for other people's land was a very important part of our revolution. And people knew it at the time. The contemporaries got it.
That's exactly right. And I think if you talk to the Americans who felt that way, or the rebelling British people who felt that way, they also had good reasons. Land was the basis of wealth, of social status, but also of political participation in both the British Empire and, of course, in the United States. And they wanted that for their families. And one of the wonderful things about history and the terrible things about history is studying people on two different sides who each think they're right. And I think in this case, it's, of course, the things that happened to American Indians are so tragic. But understanding why, I think, is the most important thing.
Well, you've contributed to that understanding with this book, Kathleen. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Kathleen Duvall, an American history professor at UNC Chapel Hill and the author of the book Independence Lost, Lives at the Edge of the American Revolution. She'll be reading from the book at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on July 30th at 7 o'clock. We have more information at our website, stateofthings.org. How the West Was Won, at least Western North Carolina, will preview a new exhibit that looks at the history of the railroads in Western North Carolina. Stay with us.